Listeners are advised that the information shared in this podcast does not equate to medical advice. For all queries regarding your health, medication, and treatment, please see your GP.
Welcome to the Connect Groups podcast series.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Emily Mostyn Brown, and I am the Training and Development Coordinator here at Connect Groups. I'm joined today by Renee Brown, the Secretary for the Australian Pompeii Association. I'd like to start off by acknowledging the traditional owners on the land with which we are recording this podcast today, the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation. I'd like to acknowledge their elders, past, present, and emerging, and anybody listening with a lived experience. Welcome, Renee.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for coming. Why don't you start off by letting us know what Pompeii is?
Sure. So Pompeii disease is a progressive muscle weakness disease. It's a lysosomal storage disorder. It is characterized by weakness of the muscles proximally rather than distally. So it is a spectrum disorder, so very tricky to spot. Even if you know what to look for in Pompeii disease patients, we're all different. It depends on which muscles are affected as to what sort of symptoms we present with. So you have two forms of Pompeii disease. You have the infantile onset Pompeii disease, which is the severe form of the disease, and it is very, very urgent that those babies get treatment. And then you have the late onset Pompeii disease, which is a little less urgent but still very, very important to diagnose early and get access to treatment to stop the muscle wasting from progressing.
And how did you get involved with the Australian Pompeii Association?
I became involved after attending my first conference. I had been diagnosed for 1 year, and it was just so great to finally find my tribe and meet other people with my disease and see them living well and coping and having a career and families and doing all the things that I was thinking maybe I couldn't have. And I wanted also to smooth the way for other people coming through so they didn't go through that terrible diagnostic odyssey of trying to find their diagnosis, and then the awfulness, which is all the appointments, trying to get access to treatment. I just wanted to, I guess, help the next lot coming through and make their journey a little bit easier than mine was.
How rare is Pompeii?
So Pompeii disease, I'm not exactly sure of the incidence or prevalence within Australia, but we are estimating 1 in 45,000. And it's usually a 1 to 10 ratio, whether it's infantile onset or late onset. So we know of about 78 patients within Australia with Pompeii disease. Most of those are late onset. Unfortunately, most of the babies with infantile onset Pompeii disease do pass away.
When it comes to getting a diagnosis, what are the steps that you would take to figure out how the signs and symptoms that might clue you in?
Look, it's so tricky. As I said, it's a spectrum disease. So I'll start with infantile because that is the most severe and the most apparent that something is terribly wrong. So there is cardiac involvement, so an enlarged heart. Cardiomyopathy, an enlarged tongue, hypertonia, so a floppy baby, feeding issues, breathing issues. It is a bit of a spectrum disorder as to how much enzyme you produce when you are born. Some babies are born producing a little bit and some are born producing none at all. So there is a bit of a spectrum within the infantile. Late onset, a lot trickier. Onset of a late onset Pompe disease could be anywhere from 1 year old to 40. It's such a massive disease spectrum. In saying that, it does depend on which muscles are targeted by the disease. So basically, Pompe disease is a lysosomal storage disorder where glycogen builds up in the muscles, overwhelms the cell, and the cell splits open and a muscle is destroyed. It's permanent, it's irreversible, so we are gradually and very insidiously becoming quite disabled without realizing it, because our bodies are very good at compensating. So paraspinal muscles, diaphragm, our breathing muscles, limb girdle muscles are affected, speech and swallowing is affected, but it does depend patient to patient as to what symptoms they have. For example, I have a paralyzed diaphragm, so I have trouble breathing, and I have limb girdle weakness, and my paraspinal muscles are missing. So I use a walker and occasionally a wheelchair, so I have difficulty walking and breathing. But other people don't have breathing issues. They may have swallowing issues and can no longer eat solid food, need a peg for feeding because their swallowing muscles are affected and their speech is slightly affected. So, such a massive spectrum of onset but also symptoms. So it makes it so incredibly difficult to diagnose.
Is it diagnosed through a blood test, genes?
Yes, so gold standard used to be a muscle biopsy, but now that's a little bit more old school, and there is a dry blood spot test, an assay test. So it's just a drop of blood from your finger onto a card, so nice and simple. You order the test through your, ideally a specialist. They send it away in a couple of weeks' time. The results come back with your enzyme levels, and that will tell you whether you have Pompe disease or not. You could also do a genetic test, but that does take a couple of months, 3 to 4 months, and if it's infantile, you just do not have that time. So a blood spot test, ideally, is the fastest way to get a diagnosis of Pompe disease.
How rapid does the muscle deterioration start to happen?
Insidiously and slowly with late onset Pompe disease. But new papers come out from Professor Priyesh Krishnani show that in a cohort of 20 children with late onset Pompe disease, the muscle damage was already occurring, even though their genetic errors were showing that they may not show symptoms and be diagnosed late until later in life. The reason those babies were flagged is through newborn screening. So they were picked up via newborn screening. They were able to study those children, and they had found that the beginnings of muscle damage had started as early as 1 and 2 years old. So so we're learning more and more about the disease every day, but there's still a long way to go.
That sounds like it. With the treatment that slows it down, do they know how much it slows it down, or is that still?
So I receive enzyme replacement therapy via a chest port every 2 weeks. And at first, I didn't notice a difference. For 6 months, I was thinking, oh no, this isn't working. And prior to my diagnosis, I was unraveling. Like, I was becoming, things were happening so slowly and insidiously, I didn't notice at first. And the things that I should have been paying attention to, I didn't realize were red flags. tripping and falling, being really unfit, not being able to walk and breathe at the same time. I just beat myself up thinking it was aging and I needed to work out more and lose some weight and get it together. And I didn't know that they were red flags until it was impossible to ignore. I couldn't walk to the letterbox. My families were going on holidays without me because it was, I just couldn't go. So at first, when I started treatment, I deflated a little bit because it took 6 months for me to realize, oh my God, I actually feel good. And I couldn't remember the last time that I felt good. And that's, and then as the glycogen started to get cleared from my system, not only did the disease progression stop, but I, with physiotherapy, I managed to gain some back, which is huge in a disease where you're told to expect decline, and it's a progressive disease. So the enzyme replacement therapy has, I feel for me, halted the disease in its tracks. And I feel like I just need to stay as well as I can for as long as I can for the next thing, for other treatments to come along. So
how long have you been diagnosed for?
So I was diagnosed in 2017 after about 10 years of looking for a diagnosis. So I've been tested for MS, and I was beginning to think I was losing my mind, and maybe I was starting to make things up in my mind. And because I was Googling my symptoms so often, if there was a thing on Current Affair about Ross River virus or chronic fatigue, there I am Googling it to see if I have Ross River or, you know, chronic fatigue with a twist of Lyme disease. I was considering anything at that point. And I did start to believe that maybe I was manifesting some of the symptoms in my mind, and maybe attention seeking at the doctors. I genuinely thought I was, maybe I had Munchausen's or something. But yeah, I was, it was a very long diagnostic odyssey, and to be told that you're fine, go home, you're okay. Maybe my breathing, I was told, was anxiety, which didn't feel right because I was pretty sure I couldn't breathe. So it was a awful time, and you do stop looking for a bit until your family G's you up and says, come on, like, we've got to get to the bottom of this, we've got to work out what kind, we're obviously just not seeing the right kind of doctor. Maybe we need to see an endo or a rheumatologist, or we just needed to work that puzzle out. So it was a very long, difficult diagnosis. And I might sound bonkers, but the day I was given my diagnosis of Pompe disease, I was elated. I was so happy to finally have a name and a right, what's next? Let's get some treatment. Let's start doing something about it.
I've heard that from a lot of people in these podcasts, that the minute that diagnosis comes in, the stress and anxiety of trying to figure out what's going wrong is overwhelming. Like, that they're just elated because they at least they have a name, they've got a condition, they can move forward.
Absolutely. And the validation and the gloating in the
you're,
car.
You're crazy.
On my way home. That's right. Like, I felt very, I think that first sort of day of, you know, feeling a little bit like I told you so, and the validation, as soon as that falls away, you realize, oh no, and then you start to think, what does this mean? Like, what, you know, I spent so long trying to fit my symptoms into a diagnosis, I didn't really stop to consider what that diagnosis at the end of the day was going to mean.
You spend so much time trying to put your symptoms into this box of what the condition is, and then you're elated because you finally have a diagnosis and a name and a title, and then that kind of emotional downfall of now this is my life, kind of, that you now are part of a certain box to say, and how you deal with that and how you cope with that and move forward.
Yeah, and it's probably very typical of a rare disease. You immediately Google your disease, and I think it was the first sentence, this fatal disease, and you know, your just world just falls away. You just think, oh, okay, like, you know, like, gosh, you start to think the worst. You think this is it. It's a terminal diagnosis. And the things that I was reading on Pompe were either the infantile version of the disease or really outdated. And it wasn't until I found the Pompe Association did I get that real reassurance that you're okay. There's a treatment, there's dietary changes, there's physiotherapy, specialized physiotherapy that you can do. You can live well with Pompe disease. It's not the diagnosis that had changed and essentially ruined my life. I'm doing little bunny ears with my fingers. It was the lateness of that diagnosis, the damage that had occurred trying to find my diagnosis, that is where the damage occurred.
If you had been diagnosed or tested as a child, would it have showed up that you had Pompe? Is it something, because especially with the infantile, that they consider when a child is born, just testing them to see, because it is so fatal for them?
Yeah, there is. We are currently speaking with the health department regarding newborn screening for Pompe disease. I'm not going to lie, it is a hugely complex issue. It's not as simple as let's test everybody, because what we're going to do, there is no specific test just for the infantile version. And what they're nervous about is they're going to diagnose someone like me who wasn't diagnosed until they're 40. And they think that that could be harmful and that might be a bad thing. And I'm saying that is such a good thing to know, to have that information, because there is no specialist physio, there's no dietary changes, there is no treatment without a diagnosis. And had I had known that I had Pompe disease, yes, again, tough diagnosis to receive, but are we really going to let people endure that diagnostic odyssey and suffer permanent disability when that is preventable? Because there's now not one treatment for Pompe disease, there are two treatments for Pompe disease plus a third available through clinical trial. So without that diagnosis, there's no clinical trials, there's no access to funded treatments, you just decline, and it is a decline. And what we know from that paper from Priya Krishnani is the decline starts a lot earlier than we appreciated. I have never been able to do a sit-up, and I have always run like a girl, like arms and knees akimbo, just not the sportiest of person and never very strong. I've always been a bit of a girly girl, but that was okay because I was a girl and I wasn't really expected to be strong or fast or tough or do sit-ups. But those were red flags that really we should have been paying attention to, because people should be able to do a sit-up and people should be able to jump. Jumping up, because I'm tall, people would say, oh, you should play netball. And I would think, yeah, but you need to be able to jump. Like, it occurred to nobody, including my parents or myself, that people can jump. people have the ability to jump, whereas I just thought it was one of those, well, that's why you're at the Olympics, because look how high you can jump.
I'm sitting here going, I can't jump very well. But yes, I can jump still, but yes, not very well. But yeah, no, that's why I was thinking, because I'm like, especially if the infants, it is fatal, then why not? And I would think that it's something that, this is my non-medical opinion,
yes,
that through those important growth years, that knowing that being able to have those treatments would actually help kids. Because to me, I would think that would be the part where, yeah, that deterioration is just going to impact your body so much as you're growing and changing into an adult.
Absolutely. And what we're seeing in America through the newborn screening process is these children with infantile onset Pompe disease, and some of these children are CRM negative, meaning born making no enzymes. So when you treat them, they immediately reject the treatment. So they are the sickest of the sick children. We're talking cardiomyopathy. They are in a really bad way, but they're picked up within a week of birth because they've been tested through a newborn screening program, and they've had access to treatment within 2 or 3 weeks of birth, and that is the difference. They are living well, they are singing, they are dancing, they are living. They're going to mainstream schools. These kids are doing well, and we don't have that here in Australia. Our children are not living. That, and it's very difficult talking to a parent who's lost a child and trying to make them feel, oh, what do you say? It's just so, so terrible. And those families are never the same. Just never the same.
If there's a parent or an individual out there who has lost a child to Pompe disease or has been diagnosed or had a child diagnosed, what is the best way for them to get in contact with you guys so that they can help find that peer support that is really important?
So we do have a website, AustralianPompeAssociation.org. So you can log in, and we do have other parents on the website that have lost children. We have parents of children with late onset that are doing really well. So if you want just some advice on how they manage, say, treatment in school or home infusions or having a port as opposed to IV access, we can put the new parents in touch with the parents that have been doing it a little while. And it's just that peer support of, they've been there, they've done that, and that's worked really well for them, and they can just give them a little bit of support, but also advice,
which is important. It helps that journey, as you said, you know, once you found the association, it kind of helped your journey a little bit more. Do you guys ever run any activities or events, especially here in WA?
We do. We are currently planning our patient conference. So we have one every 2 years. Last conference was consumpt by COVID. So we just had a little get together of our WA peeps in the Swan Valley, where we just went out for lunch and we watched a couple of online presentations. However, this year it will be in Adelaide, and we've invited our New Zealand counterparts to come and join us. So it's going to be a big conference, and everyone is absolutely busting to get together. It's been so long, and it's just really great to get together with your tribe and see old friends, but there's also a lot of newly diagnosed people that will be meeting someone with their disease for the very first time. And that's, I remember that feeling, and it was so, I was very nervous to go. I was a bit worried about what I would see, and I thought it would be quite confronting, and I found it amazing. amazing, especially in the lobby, watching everyone waddle in, because we all waddle a little bit like penguins. We have that very distinct waddling gait. So it was fantastic just to see other people walking like me but living well and having families and careers and businesses and doing amazing. I think I needed that.
I love that you call it your tribe. I think that's amazing, because it's what it becomes. It becomes like another family, another extension of you. So yeah.
Absolutely. And it's so nice. I've made some, I think, lifelong friends that I think I will have for a very long time that I would never have met had I not been diagnosed with this. But also, I think it's good for mental health to also step away from the disease for a little while and just go, you know, not this week. There's no Pompeii in the house this week. Putting it all down, and I'm having some time away from it. But when I need it and it's there, it's very, very reassuring.
All right. Well, thank you again for joining us. Really appreciate it. And if you guys want to learn any more about Pompeii disease, as Renee said, you can head to the website at Australian Pompeii Association.
Thank you very much. Yes. And also, yes, if you're listening and you do have Pompeii disease, October, Adelaide 2023 is our patient conference. So we're furiously fundraising right now to make it all happen. So register, come, we'd love to have you there.